Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello there and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments. Echoes from the Time magazine correspondent at Vatican II, 40 years on. Memories of a Pope who could quote from Hamlet. Shakespeare and Lies with our Latin lover. On several occasions since his April election, Pope Benedict XVI has reflected on the legacy of the Second Vatican Council, which ended exactly 40 years ago. But what were those council years really like? That's what I asked one person reporting on the council for Time magazine. He's well-known author and journalist Robert Blair Kaiser. In a few moments, he'll be giving us an inside look at those landmark years in the history of the Catholic Church, shining the spotlight on the key role the media once played in telling the Church and the world what the Council Fathers were discussing behind the closed doors of St. Peter's Basilica. It was 1962 when 31-year-old Bob Kaiser, fresh out of 10 years in the Jesuits, was assigned to cover the council by Time magazine. He recalls how, at first, his editors were not at all sure whether the council would grab the attention of his magazine's millions of readers. But as it turned out, the event did fuel collective imagination, as the photographs of that epoch portray, bearing witness to a hitherto unknown universality of the Church. Robert Blair Kaiser brings us echoes of that era.
For the first time in all of the Church's history, we saw that the Church was indeed universal. When you saw those cardinals, not only the cardinals, but all those bishops, there were like 2,300 of them, 2,400 by the end of the council, 2,500 maybe. When you saw them coming down the steps of St. Peter's every day at about 12:30, it looked like a waterfall of red and purple and black and so forth. They just kept tumbling down. It was a flow of bishops. And they were brown faces and black faces and yellow faces and white faces and ruddy Irish faces.
This universality you describe in such a photographic manner marked a break from the last council back in 1870, in which the council fathers were far more European, no?
In fact, about half of them were from Italy. So it was not considered a kind of ecumenical, meaning worldwide, council. It was a pretty tight little affair. There weren't native African black bishops at that council, for example. But here at Vatican II, there they were. And people like Karl Rahner, the great Jesuit theologian, pointed out in one of his papers that he wrote after the council, this was probably the biggest insight that the Church had, that the Church was indeed universal. It saw itself in a new way.
Not being allowed to be actually physically present in St. Peter's, how did you achieve collecting information?
The trick was, how do you find out what's going on inside when you can't get inside? In fact, everything was sub secreto. They had stamped on every council document sub secreto. They were all in Latin and they were all marked secret. And the bishops at first didn't know quite how to handle us, members of the press. We were outside waiting for them to come out and tell us what had happened inside.
So it was always by hearsay?
Yeah, it was secondhand. Right. Except that a few of us broke the secrecy of the council just by our actions and by getting the bishops to cooperate with us. We would find out who gave the best talks that day, and then we would go to them and I say, we understand you gave a great talk today. May we have a copy of it? And they'd give it to us. And we'd have it translated into like six or seven languages and distributed around among us. So our stuff began to appear in some of the great European newspapers and in Time magazine. It was not a Semper Idem kind of church. It was a church. Everything was up for grabs. When the bishops who were there realized that it was a kind of open season here, and that we're here to modernize the church. They use the word aggiornamento, updating. That was Pope John XXIII's favorite word. A word, by the way, that John Paul II only used once in his whole 26 and a half years in office. updating something that's unchangeable.
But Pope John Paul II spoke in his spiritual testament about the importance of Vatican II and the legacy of Vatican II. He may not have used the word aggiornamento, but he still considered Vatican II as
everyone,
the great landmark.
Everyone gives lip service to Vatican II, but it's the interpretation of Vatican II that's important. And the current Pope, Benedict XVI, has his own interpretation that is quite at variance with the interpretation that I would give it and that a lot of those giant cardinals would have given it at the beginning of Vatican II. He was, in fact, Cardinal Frings's assistant. Cardinal Frings made that first brilliant speech. It's quite possible that it was written, or at least helped being written, by none other than young Joseph Ratzinger.
Going back to the popes of the council, how did they follow the events themselves? I mean, John the 23rd is said to have followed the council from his TV screen. Did Paul VI adopt the same method?
Yes, he didn't show up.
He watched it on TV.
He watched it on TV also, right? Mm. He wanted to give the fathers the full freedom. And for the first time in the history of the church, and then it stopped, for the first time in the history of the church, we had free speech in the church, and that's what made it so exciting. Because since everything was up for grabs, and people began to realize that they could say what they had in mind for years, but were afraid to say because it looked like it was too revolutionary, they finally said, wow, yeah, we can
So talk. What do you think were the most revolutionary things that were said at the council?
They wanted to make it a people's church. It was too clerical. So one of their first projects, schemata, was on the church, and the curia people who had drawn up the draft had put the old pyramidal structure there with the Pope at the top and the bishops and then the people, priests and then the people. They switched it around. The people were in chapter 3 in the original document, but they put the people up in chapter 1. The people are the main thing. The church would look like a funny place if it didn't have any people in it. It was just composed of priests and bishops and cardinals and popes. So that was the exciting thing. They were trying to make a people's church. I don't know how they did it, because they were all clerics, and here they were trying to give the power and the responsibility to the people. And through the various documents, you can see that that's a stream that runs through all the documents, practically all of the 17. They finally ended up with 17 schemata, not 73. The first one that they did in point of time was a schema on the liturgy. And they debated that for a month. Much of the debate centered around whether they should have the Mass in the language of the people or in the language of the elite, which was Latin. And the Mass had been in Latin, in the Latin Church, in the Western Church, for, 1900 years, huh? Ever since they were doing the recreation of the Last Supper in these house churches in Rome, they did it in Latin. And now all of a sudden, here's Pope John the 23rd and the bishops, the change bishops, wanting to put the Mass in the vernacular, in all the world languages. And there was a huge debate over it. And they finally ended up voting on it, and they surprised even themselves when the vote came out about 2,000 for change and 200 for no change. That was the first debate.
Thanks there to Robert Blair Kaiser, well-known author and journalist and Rome correspondent for Time magazine in the days of the Second Vatican Council. And now while we move on in the broadcast, we continue to focus on those council years, shining the spotlight on one of the popes of that council, Paul VI, a man often described as brilliant but baffling, and sometimes even referred to as a Hamletic pope. Stay tuned as I bring you some exclusive material from our Vatican Radio sound archives in this feature I've prepared for you. Watch the change of tone.
The press which you represent can be a most potent instrument of great good. Always be faithful to the truth. That is the question.
That is the question. The words of Pope Paul VI provoked hilarity and clapping among the journalists gathered around him. They understood that reference to Hamlet's famous soliloquy. It was December 1964, and during an impromptu press conference, the Pope unleashed an unusual self-deprecating sense of humour, showing an awareness of a specific journalistic quirk, that of repeatedly reporting a quote likening him to this most famous of Shakespearean characters. It's a familiar story going back to the days when Pope Paul was still Cardinal Archbishop Montini of Milan and the Roman Pontiff his predecessor John the 23rd. Said Pope John, inquiring after the Cardinal in his home diocese of Milan, "Well, how's your Hamlet Cardinal?" A shrewd remark, never to be forgotten by the press, resurfacing when the Cardinal Archbishop of Milan was himself elected to the See of Peter in June 1963. And not just in the local press. Even the Newsweek issue marking Paul VI's recent election to the papacy, which sported his photograph still dressed as a cardinal on the cover, quoted it. Running an editorial by the title of "We Have a Pope, Paul VI, Baffling Brilliant," only a few lines down, there was an entire paragraph dedicated to the Hamlet Cardinal.
Cardinal Montini, at a more searching look, is a baffling figure both in person and in politics. Although he was the first prelate whom Pope John elevated to cardinal, the uncomplicated John apparently had ambivalent feelings about the intellectual Montini.
And Papa Montini was indeed an intellectual, a man at ease in literary circles, familiar with Shakespeare, having visited Stratford-on-Avon 3 decades earlier. As he himself once explained in the exclusive recording in English you're about to hear, "A word of warning, don't be misled by the royal we," dictated by the papal protocol of the time. Pope Paul was speaking about himself.
"The visit we made about 30 years ago as an inquiring and hasty tourist to the city and the home of Shakespeare in Stratford-on-Avon. With the impression of fantastic riches and psychological truth."
The impression of fantastic riches and psychological truth, said Pope Paul, speaking on the occasion of celebrations for the 4th centenary of the birth of Shakespeare. It was 1964. Among his audience, directors and actors of the Royal Stratford Theatre, exceptionally performing in Rome, just down the road from St. Peter's.
"The commemoration is particularly adapted to Rome, always savvy and prone as she is to honor the high achievements of the human spirit, and happy today to celebrate in this supreme writer the magnificent cultural tradition and artistic genius of the English people."
Shakespeare's writings, Paul VI stressed, were profoundly human, ever open to adventurous and poetic exploration, leading to the discovery of moral laws which make life great and sacred.
"God exists. There is a life after this life. Evil doing is punished and good rewarded."
Clearly for Pope Paul VI, genius and faith could go hand in hand. He believed Shakespeare's lofty genius and powerful language would induce humankind to listen with great reverence to the great truths expounded in his works. Perhaps that affinity to Hamlet constantly attributed to him, stemming from his apparent inability to merely brush aside the daunting difficulties in his personal quest for truth, may not have displeased him altogether. But why not listen then to that famous soliloquy?
to be or not to be? That is the question. Whether it is nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles, and by opposing, end them.
In the twilight years of his 15-year pontificate, Paul VI may have fleetingly remembered John XXIII's remarks while jotting down a series of notes.
"What is my state of mind?" he wrote. "Am I Hamlet or Don Quixote? On the left, on the right, I don't feel I have properly been understood. Who knows whether or not he was understood as Pope? What's certain is that the man to inherit from his predecessor to the papacy, a council it is said he would never have called, was a prudent and far-sighted man who avoided those kind of decisions where another would have acted first and reflected later." A big thank you to our Vatican Radio sound engineers for making that program possible. But now, to stay with our Shakespearean theme, it's time to join our Latin lover, Carmelite Father Reginald Foster. Father, I'd like to speak to you about Shakespeare and lies today. Lies like telling lies. How would you translate the word Shakespeare in Latin?
Well, Shakespeare, Well, Shakespeare is the Shakespeare, you know. Quatiens telum.
Quatiens telum?
Yeah, shaking the spear.
And lie?
It doesn't work.
What do you mean? How do you say a lie?
It's okay.
The Eighth Commandment.
Yeah.
How do you translate the Eighth Commandment?
Mendacium.
You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor.
Falsum testimonium. Non facies falsum testimonium adversus proximum tuum. You will not make non facies. I find a mistake in the Vulgate, says. That's all right.
As I said, I'm going to talk about Shakespeare and the lies. But now I'm going to quote from Shakespeare as you like
it.
A courteous retort. Quote, "Sir, I am not of your opinion. I beg to differ from you."
I am not of your opinion. That's easy. Tue opiniones non sum ego. Velim, I'd like to...
I beg to differ from you.
Velim tecum dissentire.
Would the Romans have spoken that way?
Well, I don't see why not. How are you going to know how you say it? I don't know. Velim tecum dissentire. I would like to disagree with you.
A countercheck. How do you say countercheck?
What is a countercheck? What does that mean?
To disagree, basically.
And what is the text?
The text is Shakespeare, As You Like It. How do you translate
As You Like It? Ut tibi placet.
Okay, a quote from Ut tibi placet. Sir, how dare you utter such a falsehood? Sir, you know that is not true.
Yeah.
Well, sir.
Quomodo domine. Quomodo audes tantum proferi mendacium. To bring out such a falsehood.
Sir, you know that is not true.
You know. Illud verum non esse novisti. You know that's not true.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about disagreeing as a countercheck, which is probably not something you would use so much today. More prosaically, the word counter, how would you say under the counter, meaning black market?
Oh, Lord, deliver us how they said that. I don't even know. Under the counter. Clam or secreto, secretly, or clam, secretly. Or, you know, abscondito, secretly. You have to go from language to language. That's the problem here. And
then we've just spoken about the black market under the counter. We go back to our theme. Did the Romans tell white lies?
White lies. That's another one. Well, they didn't have the word for white lies, that's for sure.
Oh, you see, I caught you out.
Yeah.
The Romans didn't have a
They probably did tell white lies, but mendacium honesta. Well, honest lies. Mendacia proba, good lies. But didn't have the idea of, white, black, green, blue, black. They didn't have white lies. They didn't. There's no such thing in Latin as a mendacium candidum. Bah! Candidum mendacium would be an honest lie.
It's a contradiction. Is there a contradiction between Shakespeare and the Romans, or do you think that Shakespeare had a Roman mind, a Latin mind?
Oh, my Lord, Shakespeare got everything from the Romans. What are you talking about? And half of his plays were, I won't say, translations from the Romans. From Plautus, on the way to the Forum, I don't know this other, what is the other, he has a famous thing. One man on the way to the Forum and all this other stuff. He got all his characters and everything is from the Romans.
Are you accusing him of plagiarizing?
Just about.
How'd you say plagiarizing in Latin?
Well, that's Greek. But, furtum, sunt furta literaria, literary robberies.
You can't lie about that. He did that.
Yeah, I know him, but the fact is he got many, many things. Mm. Oh, heaven's sake. You think, for example, Julius Caesar,
Coriolanus, Titus and Andronicus.
Coriolanus, all that stuff is
Titus
from...
Titus and Andronicus.
Andronicus is the word.
Sorry, I apologize.
Anyway, but he got all that stuff from the Romans. What do you mean?
But there's one word that neither Shakespeare nor the Romans would know about, and that's a lie detector.
A lie detector? No, there's no problem there. Mendaciorum detector. A detector of lies. Which is the man who does it. Oh, I don't care.
Heartfelt thanks there, as always, to Carmelite Father Reginald Foster for sharing with us his scholarly expertise and affording us entertainment as he goes along. Father Foster is currently working at the Vatican's Secretariat of State as the Pope's own Latinist. Finally, on a more reflective note, we join well-known theologian and author Jesuit Father Gerald O'Collins for some spiritual inspiration focusing on forgiveness.
Begin with a little wisdom from the writer G.K. Chesterton. Chesterton once said, "I find it easy to love Eskimos because I've never seen an Eskimo, but I find it hard to love my neighbour. Late at night he plays the piano right over my head." Well, we all have something to forgive, perhaps much to forgive. And it won't be as simple as someone playing the piano into the night. It may be our own family who need forgiveness, or it may be a case of friends who have let us down. Whatever it is, forgiveness is difficult and costly. In one of his novels, the French writer Jean-Paul Sartre makes fun of a happy character who can see no difficulty in forgiving. This character believes that the only thing needed to settle our differences is a little common sense. If only it were as easy as that. To forgive means that we should be prepared to sacrifice our rights. What's past can't be undone, but the future is open. We can forgive and create a new relationship. To give to others is not always easy. To forgive them can be much harder, even heroic. Jesus has sometimes been described as the man born to give. He could also be described as the man born to forgive. He took a lot of criticism during his lifetime. Many people thought Jesus was scandalous in the extent to which he was so ready to forgive. He left us a wonderful prayer that stresses forgiveness. In the Lord's Prayer, or Our Father, we ask for ourselves, "Forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us." That's an essential point in Jesus' program of love. He forgives us our sins as we too forgive all who have done us wrong. Nothing shows more clearly God's love towards us than God's forgiveness. Nothing shows more clearly our love towards others than the forgiveness we can offer to each other. This is perhaps the one point where Jesus expects his followers even to boast before God about what they are doing. The Our Father doesn't tell us to pray, "Give us this day our daily bread as we give others their daily bread." And the Our Father doesn't tell us to pray, "Lead us not into temptation," just as we don't lead others into temptation. But the Our Father does demand that we forgive each other. Praying that and doing that can be very hard. A lot harder than forgiving and loving some piano-playing neighbour at night time. May our loving God give us all the grace of being truly forgiving persons.
Collins is a Jesuit who is currently based in Wimbledon, England, and is also a well-known author. And that brings us up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. If you did, please let me know. Our email address is english@vatiradio.va. Or if you wish to drop me a line, the address is The English Programme, Vatican Radio, Vatican City. Thanks for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbury. Be sure to check out our website. The address is www.vaticanradio.org/English. Bye for now, and don't forget that we'll be back again at the same time tomorrow.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.